please be seated. So we have some students here today visiting.
What school are you in?
You're in Lynn? Okay, what grade are you in? Okay, good. Good. Well, we're glad we have some excellent attorneys here, so I hope you enjoy our arguments and maybe counsel and kind of tone down some of the subject matter if you feel comfortable. I mean, bring up whatever you need to bring up with the students here and like that. And we'll go ahead and call the case. This is case number 58568, Johnny Marquez versus the state of Nevada. Mr. Jackson representing the plaintiffs, representing the appellant. Go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I please court counsel, Terrence Jackson for Johnny Marquez. It's my privilege today to argue to the court on Mr. Marquez's behalf because I think there are numerous issues that require reversal in this case. Each of the errors in this case that I've enumerated in my brief, I think, could result in reversal, but the cumulative effect of them, I think, mandate reversal. And I'm going to start with what I think is the most fundamental issue that I raised, and the court can direct me to whatever issues the court deems appropriate. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal if the court, the timekeeper can let me know.
We have a lot of issues that we're going to ask about, Mr. Jackson, both sides, so we may go a little bit longer depending on how it goes. I know I have several areas I'd like to focus in on, but why don't you go ahead and proceed on whatever you'd like to talk about first.
I think they all interrelate. You know, the main thing is I don't think the defendant got a fair trial. He didn't get a fair trial. He didn't get to present his case. And he wished to recall witnesses that were essential. Now, the government argued, and the judge intervened and said, you have to establish that these witnesses are going to help you. That was the victim and the victim's mother. In fact, the judge was adamant that he would be harassing these witnesses. I don't think there was anything on the record establishing that Mr. Lucarini did anything to harass either of these witnesses in his questioning. Mm-hmm. And I think they're shifting the burden. The defendant does not have the burden to show when he subpoenas someone or when he wants to call someone as a witness that these witnesses are going to help him. If they don't, the jury's going to find out soon enough. If he calls a witness and it doesn't help him, the jury's going to say, that's not very helpful. But Mr. Lucarini was trying to make a record. The judge said, no, you get your chance on cross-examination, but you're not going to call this young girl back. I think he was being overprotective. Now, I've cited case law. I think it was Davis versus Alaska. United States Supreme Court case saying, you know, the fundamental right to bring witnesses, you know, shouldn't be impaired simply because you have other concerns. It's the state's burden to show that there really is some strong reason to restrict this fundamental right. And they didn't meet it here.
And Jackson, didn't you have an opportunity to fully and thoroughly examine the witnesses? What is the purpose of not doing that the first time they are in cross-examination as opposed to recalling
them? He believed that there was other evidence that could come out. It happens all the time in cases that you call people on recross or redirect or whatever. And he believed that once he had the stepfathers and the father on the witness stand, he could have brought out further impeaching information. Now, he wasn't able to make an adequate proffer, and I believe, though, that he was going to discuss with them issues surrounding possibly what they told the stepfather. I would have asked, you know, I could say what I would have asked. I don't know if I want to go into that in detail here, but, you know, the mother, in fact, didn't believe this little girl at one time. Now, after CPS got involved, after CPS was going to get involved threatening the child, then the mother came around and became a witness for the state, much more on the side of the government. Now, I think, you know, a question of the stepfather and the father, After they were questioned, I might have wanted to ask the child, did you say anything different?
Mr. Jackson, let me have a comment. I guess for the record now, about 5 minutes into the argument, the students from the fifth grade class have left the courtroom, so feel free to say whatever you'd like to say.
Well, you know, it might have asked the child questions about whether or not she had said something different to her stepfather than she did to her mother, because her stepfather, you know, was, or rather the natural father, I confused the two, might have, was the first one who apparently believed that she had done something. In any event, this was an important issue, and Mr. Lipperini didn't seem to be able to convince the judge. But there were other issues. You know, the first issue was whether or not Mr. Lipperini should have been the attorney. The judge didn't grant a hearing on that. He basically said Mr. Lipperini is a good attorney, and he didn't allow the defendant to make his case as far as getting a substitute attorney. Now,
let me make sure we understand that Mr. Marquez did not ask to represent himself.
He wanted a substitute attorney.
So there's no Feretta issues.
It's not a Feretta situation.
Okay.
He wanted an attorney other than Mr. Lucarini, and he said Mr. Lucarini hadn't done the investigation, hadn't consulted with him, et cetera, et cetera. And he wanted it, but there wasn't a hearing on this. The judge basically said, no, Mr. Lucarini's, you know, good attorney, that's it, you know, and he didn't go into it.
Mr. Jackson, there was a brief exchange on the record, and the counsel that showed up out of Mr. Lucarini's office on that day did have to admit as to whether or not they had actively been seeing Mr. Marquez. That might have been true based upon Mr. Marquez's representation. At that point, they didn't get into the discovery issue at a subsequent hearing, though Mr. Lucarini talked about the additional discovery and what he had and what he had turned over to Mr. Marquez that might help him. And because of the time of the trial, there seemed to be, at that point, sufficient contact between the attorney and the client as to preparation. But that's just my overview of this case.
Well, the government argued, of course, that Mr. Marquez's motion was untimely, and I don't think that should be the standard, because I don't think the state would be prejudiced if the trial was continued for a short period of time for substitute counsel to come in. I think the defendant's prejudice would be much greater than the state. But I'd like to move on to other issues just briefly. The two issues are kind of related and similar, and those are the issues regarding the other crimes or bad act issues and the issue regarding the comment on a privilege. They both deal with issues regarding evidence that maybe should or shouldn't have come in, or when it did come in, whether it should have been limited. The bad acts evidence was evidence concerning domestic violence and threats to the defendant's wife. It came in inadvertently, and of course, this was a situation where maybe Mr. Lucarini wasn't prepared, but when it did come in, he tried to get it, you know, stop it, but the judge let the prosecution keep on with it, and it was highly prejudicial. This is the kind of evidence that this court has reversed on in a number of cases. Juries, I think, are extremely offended by someone who has evidence of other crimes, and it's, in a close case like this, I think it is extremely prejudicial. But when you add that to the other error, which was what I think was a comment on a privilege, when the police officer asked Mr. Marquez to provide a buccal swab for DNA, and Mr. Marquez said, no, not unless I have my attorney, or you know, I want to speak to my attorney first, he was invoking a privilege. He didn't have to do that because he hadn't been convicted of anything. And the state even argued that in the closing argument. I mean, this is a comment on a privilege. It's like commenting on a Miranda right. When you comment on a privilege, I think the Griffin case makes very clear that this is the kind of thing that the jurists are extremely concerned about. They see all kinds of TV shows about DNA and whatever, and somebody said, no, I'm not going to give you my DNA. The first thing they think is he's hiding something. It's like saying, I don't want to take a polygraph. He said, no, I don't want to unless I have my attorney. He's invoking his Sixth Amendment rights. Not only was there an objection, but the government argued this in their closing argument, exacerbating the error and the harm. This made the trial unfair. But I want to just comment briefly on the whole mood of the trial, which I picked up from reading the record. I wasn't there, but I read the record, and I read some of the comments of Judge Smith. Now, I admire Judge Smith. I've worked with him. I think he's a good judge. But I think in this case, for whatever reason, he seemed very harsh on Mr. Lucarini. And there were a couple times when he took the role of advocate. And there was one particularly, one statement that I thought where he asked a question that I think was totally improper, which I cited in my brief, that really took the role of the advocate that I think went way beyond the role of what a neutral judge should do. And I'd like to just direct the court's attention to that. The court's question was, why would the six-year-old not want to go to your house but want to go to her dad's house? And the defendant answered, I couldn't answer that. Now, maybe that's a question a prosecutor could ask, but the court shouldn't be involved in asking that question, because what does the jury think? The jury's sitting there looking at the defendant sitting in the defendant's chair, and they got the judge saying, well, why would the little girl not want to go to your house, but she'll go to her dad's house? The court shouldn't get involved in that role of an advocate. And there's plenty of cases.
Let's say we agree with you on that.
Okay.
Maybe that's more the province of the prosecutor, the defense attorney, or perhaps the jury to inquire into if the judge permitted jury questions. Is that harmless, or is that you think that that constitutes reversible?
I think it does when you look at the other statements the court made. He talked about veiled threats. He talked about you walking on thin ice, counsel. He made a number of comments to Mr. Lucarini, like Mr. Lucarini was walking on the edge, like Mr. Lucarini was maybe doing some things that were a little bit, you know, not right. And in a close case, I think that creates difficulties, because a jury, but number one, we're dealing with a sexual assault on a child case, not a case of bank robbery or a case of, you know, burglary or something like that. Initially, when a jury first hears something like that, they're prejudiced against the defendant. This was a close case because there wasn't any physical evidence. The only real evidence he had was the testimony of a young child, an 8-year-old child or whatever. So if they pick up that the judge is hostile to the defendant, if they get some prosecutorial misconduct as well by making comments on privileges, if they get some other crime evidence...
Mr. Jackson, let's go back into that, and I know we're chewing into your time, but as our chief of the panel said, we'll give you some additional time. There's an issue of whether Mr. Marquez, in this discussion, opened the door as the DNA as to their defense and what they put forth, and how are they construed? Because the law is kind of soft in this area, and the record doesn't seem to show that there was an objection by defense as to some of these DNA statements.
Okay.
So it's unobjected to, at least initially.
I think the government is kind of making a comparing apples and oranges there, or maybe raisins to pumpkins, because what you got is a situation where what happened in this case is the defendant properly raised the fact that there was no DNA evidence available. Well, they couldn't do tests of the girl because it was too long before anything that was reported. So in his cross-examination of the state's case, there was no DNA. He asked the police officers, whatever. So once he did that, that doesn't open the door to question the defendant why he didn't provide DNA. It's a totally different thing. He invoked a privilege, which was perfectly constitutional. The fact that he raised a privilege, he still has a right to question the government about the fact that they have no evidence. They have no evidence of DNA. It was totally unrelated. They're two unrelated things. And he was prejudiced by the fact that they brought this out. The government wasn't prejudiced by him asking, was there any DNA available in this case? There certainly wasn't. And that's a exculpatory thing. He's got a right to bring that out and a duty to bring that out. And so he shouldn't be punished.
We're looking at this as plain error?
I believe so. I believe it is because it's a comment on a constitutional privilege, Fifth Amendment privilege. My time has run out. I hope.
Mr. Jackson, you need another 5 minutes in rebuttal, so we'll add 5 minutes to Mr. Murbach's time.
Thank you,
also, Mr. Jackson, would you take a look when you come back on page 8 of the state's answer brief about the Terrell Young factors about not getting along with counsel and you know, whether or not that was satisfied in this case. I'm glad Justice Sater knows a lot about Terrell Young since she did the retrial, so we're quite familiar with that case. So, Mr. Murbach, if you go ahead and proceed on behalf of the state.
Your Honors, Counsel, may it please the Court. My name is Jake Murbach. I represent the respondent in this case, the state of Nevada. I'd like to begin with specifically the domestic violence issue, unless the Court has something else it would like me to address. I think it's important to note that the state did not seek admission of this evidence under 48.045. At any point in time, the state did not file a motion and was not seeking, even when the evidence was admitted, to be admitted under 48.045. It was admitted to explain a witness's conduct after that witness was impeached on cross-examination. Nothing related to the domestic violence was brought up at any time by the state prior to the cross-examination of Pamela. And then prior to that issue being raised by the defense on their cross-examination, the state actually, at a bench conference, warned the defense that that issue would come up, that door would be opened if certain questions were asked, specifically regarding why Pamela, the mother in this case, sided with the defendant, why she did not believe her daughter initially, why she might have done certain things in against her daughter, and why she was supportive of the defendant. That those types of questions hammered her as to why she did that could potentially open that up. Despite this warning from the state, so the state gave that warning to the defense prior to any of those questions being asked, and despite that warning, the defense continued on with that line of questions. In fact, the defense attorney asked the witness, why didn't you move out? Why didn't you leave him and go back to those casino jobs that you had and get your own apartment? At one point, he asked her, did he ever try to kill you? Because she had mentioned, as a response to one of his questions, that she didn't move out because she was afraid of him. He threatened that he would try to kill her, anyone she was with, and her baby. That specific answer was brought out during cross-examination by defense counsel. And when those statements come out, when the defense counsel brought those statements out, the answers to those questions themselves, only make sense if the jury knows that there was some physical abuse going on.
Would you make the same argument with respect to the DNA evidence?
Absolutely. I think that the DNA applies in the exact same way. If you look at how the DNA evidence came out, it's the exact same scenario. It was never brought up by the state. The state never at any point in time during their case in chief brought it back to the defendant or refused a DNA sample. Not until the redirect of the defendant by defense counsel is there statements made by the defendant and by defense counsel regarding the defendant's request, the statements made by the police about DNA and requests by the defendants to have the police do investigation, to thoroughly investigate the case?
As the DNA, there was a broad objection into this constitutionally, but it also talks in terms of relevance of the DNA in terms of this particular case, and that there was no DNA because of the lapse of time as the young lady. So what is the relevance of the non-submission if it was a situation you had DNA, it becomes relevant. But why is it relevant in this case?
I would absolutely agree with Your Honor that the refusal to give a DNA sample was not relevant in the case in chief in this case because there wasn't any DNA. And I would absolutely agree with that. But the way it becomes relevant is by the statements made by the defendant during his direct examination from defense counsel.
Why is that relevant when you're able to adduce other statements that because of the time delay, there was no DNA to even attempt to match? So why does that become relevant?
Because
it's not more prejudicial than probative in this instance.
I think, Your Honor, it's because the evidence is not specifically relevant as to the DNA and what happened with the DNA in this case. The evidence is relevant to show inconsistencies or impeach the defendant himself in his testimony. He gets up on the stand and he says on multiple occasions that he wanted investigation, that there was DNA talked about in this case, and that he can't get up there and he can't talk about, on multiple occasions on direct examination from his counsel, that he wants a thorough investigation, that he wants DNA compared in this case, and then expect not to be impeached with the fact that he refused to give a DNA sample. It clearly does not become...
Was that refusal to, from the state standpoint, purely show guilt, or was it to show that DNA wasn't relevant in this case? I guess that's my real question.
It was to show the inconsistencies. It was to impeach the defendant. It was to impeach the defendant. He was testifying. He was on the stand. He was making specific statements in regards to the thorough investigation he requested. In fact, there was one point Mr. Lucarini asked him, looking at all the reports you see in this case...
As a fundamental issue, was it a lie to state that there was no DNA evidence?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Was there a lie to state that there was no DNA evidence, in essence? That's what he's saying, that, well, there's no DNA.
Did the detective make that statement? I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'm asking you this hypothetical while you're trying to impeach his testimony. Had he misstated that there was no DNA or no DNA linking him, and...
He had not misstated that, but what he had misstated is he had said that he wanted a thorough investigation of this case, that he knew... He says at one point that somebody must have done this. He actually implicates another individual, Juan, and he says...
And that's become common parlance for defense to put on in so many cases that, gee, no fingerprints were recovered at the scene of a crime, or we have no matches, forcing the state just to have to put someone to go through the rhetoric of why there was none in general in a particular case. Why does it make it so important or relevant for you to introduce a statement that he refused to submit to DNA?
I agree with you, Your Honor, that it's not relevant simply because there's no DNA in this case. So when even when there's testimony given by the detective that there was no DNA in this case, that there is no DNA in this case, that refusal by the defendant doesn't become relevant at that point. It's not appropriate for the state to bring it up at that point. It only becomes appropriate when the defendant himself on the stand says, I wanted this case investigated. I believe that something had happened. I wanted to find out who did it. I asked the police to interview people. I asked the police to complete a thorough investigation. I wanted this case investigated. Yet at the same time, he's refused to provide him with a DNA sample. He can't get on the stand and talk about what he wanted done in this case and how it was not done and all that he requested, while at the same time knowing that he didn't participate in the investigation. He actually didn't want the case investigated. He refused to even give it a sample in the case. And it's not relevant. I would agree with the court, it's not relevant because there's no DNA in this case. It's relevant because the defendant himself gets on the stand and makes statements which, if you look at what actually happened, simply are not true. Simply are not true statements. His desire to have the case investigated, his desire for thorough DNA examination, is not true when you look at what actually happened in this case. And it's at that point that evidence becomes relevant. And I would note for the court also, there's a U.S. Supreme Court case, South Dakota versus Neville. In that case, the Supreme Court talked about a refusal to take a blood sample, and that test was not protected by the privilege against self-incrimination. And the court actually said that not only was that refusal not protected by the privilege against self-incrimination, it was not improper for the state to use the refusal to take the test as evidence of guilt. So in that case, the court even said I would agree with the court that I did not attempt to bring this in until the defendant's specific statement regarding how much investigation he wanted done in the case. But even beyond that, the Supreme Court has said that it is not improper for there to be a comment about a refusal to take a test by the defendant. I think that applies specifically to the fact that DNA is not testimonial. It does not fall within the Fifth Amendment protection. And that's under the Wade case. And one other thing I would add that Mr. Jackson commented on is the statement by the defendant that he the state shouldn't have commented on this because the defendant made a statement that he requested an attorney. However, I would note, if the court looks in the record, that the appellant, during direct examination, is the one that brings out the fact that he asked for an attorney. He says, his attorney asks him, to the point where you even asked for an attorney, and the appellant says, yes, I did. That is where that information is brought out. It is never brought out by the state. It is brought out by the defense on the defense's direct of the appellant himself. And the state's comment in closing isn't, well, look, he requested an attorney. The state's comment in closing is, look how many different answers the defendant has given in regards to his DNA. He's told you that he didn't want to give DNA. He's told you that he wanted to give DNA, just not to this detective. He's told you that he...
We're still back to a relevancy issue. This was not a DNA case. We don't have it. That wasn't proffered by the state that there's a DNA match or DNA was there or, and he's not in the database. That's not our facts. So it's an interesting area, and I'm very well aware, as I indicated before, it came in, they didn't object to it, so we're in a plain error situation.
And in fact, I think they didn't object to it two different times. Not only did they not object to it at the bench, but when I actually asked to have the exhibit marked and admitted, they said, specifically, I have no objection, Judge. So they had brought this information out. They had started to talk about it. It was not brought out by the state. And when the state, and I also note, Your Honor, that the state didn't just start talking about this after the defense stopped their direct examination of the defendant. We approached the bench, and out of the hearing of the jury, we talked about this issue. We talked about it with defense counsel and with the court, and the court agreed that we could go forward on this issue, and defense counsel refused to object, did not object to the issue. So it's not like this is a statement that the state just makes at some point in time during the examination. It is clearly covered out of the presence of the jury before anything is brought up. It's agreed to by the defense, and it becomes relevant, Your Honor. And I understand, I would completely agree with your analysis, Your Honor, that it's not relevant because there's no DNA in this case. It doesn't become relevant until the defendant himself says, I wanted this case investigated. I wanted things done in this case. I asked, and nothing was done. And when he says that, while at the same time knowing that he refused to even give a DNA sample, that becomes relevant for his impeachment. That becomes relevant because it's something that he did that is an exactly the opposite position to what he is now testifying to under oath in front of the jury. I would like to just briefly, I don't know if the court wants to hear more about the domestic violence issue, but I wanted to just briefly mention the U.S. v. Panabianco case. It's a Second Circuit case in which there was some death threats that were made by the defendant, and it's exactly the same as this case. The state doesn't mention the death threats during their direct of the witness. During cross, the issues surrounding the death threats are brought up by the defense, and on a redirect, the prosecution is allowed to go back and clarify the matter, talking about the scenario in which those threats took place. And the court held that where cross-examination has been used to elicit an incomplete picture, which gives a distorted impression of a witness's credibility, the prosecution should generally be allowed to set the record straight on redirect. And that's exactly what happened here. The state warned the defense that if you go there, and the court warned the defense, if you go there, this could potentially happen. And when he starts asking questions about why she didn't move out, why didn't you leave him? He answers questions that elicit from her a response that he threatened to kill me and my potential boyfriend and my baby. He elicits all of that from her. And when that comes out, it becomes relevant that there was some abuse going on. And I would also note for the court that when the state asks the questions, nothing is brought up in regards to specific instances of abuse. The state just generally asks the question that there was some abuse going on. And I think that is absolutely became relevant and necessary in order to explain the conduct of the witness based upon the questions asked by the defense. I would also, with the court's permission, like to address the substitution of counsel issue. I think it's really important to understand the dates in which this took place. So July 9th, the appellant files his motion for substitution of counsel. On the 21st, and it's important to note that all of the issues in the motion have to do with lack of investigation and lack of contact. There's nothing about, you know, he's yelling at me or he told me that he doesn't like me. There's nothing like that. It's all just lack of investigation. On July 21st, the court denies the motion. On August 4th is the calendar call. The court, at that point in time, based upon Mr. Lucarini's statements and a conference of the bench, continues the case. And the case does not go to trial until 6 months later, until January 31st of 2011, so actually more than 6 months. I would also note Mr. Lucarini said, on that August 4th, 2010 calendar call date, he said, well, what I told him is that we have quite a bit of stuff we obtained from CPS through our own investigation. So Mr. Lucarini goes in there at the August 4th calendar call and says, I agree, we're investigating the case, we have a lot more to do, we need more time. And unlike all of the other cases that are cited by the defense in this case, the Wynn case, the Young case, the Gonzalez case, the court gives him 6 more months to investigate the case, to look into things, and never again does the defendant mention that he's not satisfied with counsel, that he's not being visited, that he wants a different attorney. So I think that factual scenario is extremely important here and differentiates this case from all the cases cited by the defense, where the complaint was made sometimes well before trial, but always as trial was beginning or during trial. I mean, in the Wynn case that the defense cites, during the course of the trial, the defendant on multiple occasions says, I don't want this attorney anymore, and the attorney himself says that he's unable that the defendant won't cooperate with him and that he can't get anything out of him. And that clearly distinguishes this from this case. I would agree that if Mr. Marquez had made statements immediately prior to the January 31st trial, I still haven't had anything done, I still have problems with my attorney, then there would have had to have been a hearing. I would absolutely agree with that. But those statements were not made. And the court, if you look at the factors in Garcia, the extent of the conflict, it wasn't that extensive because investigation solved it. The timeliness of the motion, it was prior to trial, but most importantly, the adequacy of the inquiry. There wasn't a need for an inquiry here because the court was continuing the case in order to fix the problem, to cure the conflict that the defendant saw at that point in time, and he never raised it again. In regards to
the first time the issue with Mr. Lucarini was raised was in July, and is that the first and only time he's brought up?
He filed a motion on July 9th. The defendant filed a motion on July 9th. It was brought up at the July 21st hearing. The court addressed it briefly, but the court said, well, we'll look at what's going on August 4th on the calendar call date. And when we showed up on the calendar call, Mr. Lucarini was there, and he said, I've got these records, I need to talk to them, I need more time, and the court continued the case.
And there was no objection by Mr. Marquez after that to Mr. Lucarini?
In my review of the record, and if you look at what defendant points out as being the claims by the defendant, in my review of the record, I do not recall the defendant ever again raising the issue that he wanted an attorney other than Mr. Lucarini. Now, I know that did happen after the verdict. Now, after the verdict, Mr. Lucarini made a comment to the court that the defendant wanted a new attorney for appeal, but clearly that's different than him saying on the day prior to trial, hey, I want a new attorney, Mr. Lucarini hasn't done enough.
Mr. Lucarini filed notice of appeal in this case, did he not?
I believe he filed the notice, but I think that based upon his, at the time of sentencing, my recollection is based upon what he believed at that time to be conflict between himself and the defendant and the appellant, he asked for new counsel to be appointed. I believe that's when Mr. Jackson was appointed.
Okay, and Mr. Murray, on the judicial bias allegations, I know in your brief you go through each of the examples and comment on them, what the appellant has raised, but it seems to me maybe the judge might have got a little bit more than just clarifying facts or things like that with some of these comments. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think, first of all, obviously the court has to consider this matter the record as a whole, and not just specific comments. But if you look at some of the specific comments, I think the most compelling ones I'd like to address. One, where he says to defense counsel, don't be looking at me that way. That happened at a bench conference. If you look in the record, it's clear that that is a bench conference. That's not said in the presence of the jury. That's said while we're up at the bench. The question, the statement by the judge, are you testifying? This is in response to a statement by Mr. Lucarini where Mr. Lucarini says, while questioning a witness, normal little kids don't ask these types of questions. That's what Mr. Lucarini says to the witness. That's clearly improper, and he says to Mr. Lucarini, I think what's clearly appropriate, are you attempting to testify, Mr. Lucarini?
Isn't that why the state's there to object?
And I would note, Your Honor, that on a large number of the 14 comments laid out by the defense, there are responses by the court due to objections from the state. Most of the 14 comments laid out by the defense are either responses to objections by the state or comments to Mr. Lucarini when he's interrupting a witness or interrupting the court himself. That's the vast majority.
Counsel, I would submit that you ran along the whole line of commentary that you were just describing about whether or not Mr. Lucarini is testifying, but it may have been in response to an objection, but the court stating he is, he has been all along, neither directs one side to clean up its commentary or sustains or overrules the objection. Would you agree with me?
Well, I would potentially, I think that but if you look at at how many times he's told Mr. Lucarini, don't continue to testify, you're not testifying, he sustained objections. This has gone on over and over again during the trial. I think the issue is Mr. Lucarini attempted to create an issue where Juan, who's the stepfather, had showed pornography to the victim. There is absolutely no evidence that it ever occurred. No one ever testified to that. It was Mr. Lucarini asking questions of witnesses attempting to create that situation. And the court allowed him to do it despite objections from the state. But when he continued to do it, when he didn't get the answers he wanted, and he continued to fight for some type of evidence regarding the defendant, Juan, showing pornography to the victim, and he couldn't get it, the court started to, at that point in time, overrule him, and eventually made comments to him about, are you testifying, and he's been testifying all along. It happened over and over again. I think if you look at it in the context of how long it occurred for, the court's comments become relevant. And I would note,
if an attorney is continuously annoying, sorry, but that's what you're describing, which happens, if an attorney is continuously annoying, then it is okay for the judge to go outside of his role and that is to either overrule or sustain an objection and simply say, yeah, he's been testifying all along.
No, I don't. I agree with the court that potentially that's not a reason for.
Go ahead and finish your comment.
That's not a reason for the court to do that. But I would say that when you look at how many times that objection had been sustained, the leeway which Mr. Lucarini had been given in that area, and where he was going when this comment was made, I don't think it's that inappropriate of a comment if you consider the record as a whole.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Murek. Mr. Jackson, you have 5 minutes.
Well, again, this was a case that had a number of issues. I'm going to try to just hopscotch a little bit on a couple of them. I think the main issue I want to touch on is whether or not Mr. Lucarini was prevented from doing what he needed to do to protect his client. He wanted to recall two witnesses. Maybe he didn't lay out a good enough proffer, but I don't think he has to lay out exactly what the witnesses are going to say to call witnesses back. You know, if you had to have every witness that you called as a witness provide something useful, you'd have to screen out about 90% of your witnesses, because when you put witnesses on the stand, they don't always deliver what you wanted or expected. In this case, he wanted to call witnesses that were obviously adverse, the victim and the mother. But he's got a right to do that under the Sixth Amendment. These witnesses, he believed, he could get some useful nuggets of information from them, especially after the stepfather and father had testified. Now, he doesn't have to order his testimony according to the way the prosecutor wants to do it or the way the judge wants to do it. He has a fundamental right under the Constitution, I believe, to call these witnesses, absent unusual circumstances. The government and the judge reversed the situation. They said, no, you got to show a burden that you got a right to do it. It's the other way around. He's got the right, and they got to show that somehow he doesn't, one of the exceptions come in. There was no showing he was harassing this young girl or the mother for that. There was nothing to show that. If he had called the young girl or the mother as witnesses, and after 5 or 10 questions, it was obvious he was just repeating what he did on direct, or he was harassing him, the prosecutor could have objected and said, enough of this. This is irrelevant. This is not helpful. This is harassment. And the judge probably would have been correct in sustaining any further questioning.
But counsel, as to Pamela, the questions were based on information elicited, as you say, by Gonzalez and Vasquez. But I understand it correctly. They testified before she testified originally.
That's true, but only a few minutes before. And he really, it was like a space of what? Just no more than an hour or so before. So, I mean, he wanted to call his case indirect. And I don't think that gave him an adequate time to really digest her testimony. You need to take home and digest it overnight, think what questions you're going to ask or whatever. And I'll concede the argument isn't as strong for Pamela as it would be for the young child. So the court, there may be a distinction there, but I think it's a very minor distinction. And I think he still has an absolute right under the Constitution to subpoena this witness if he believes that there's some information that could be gained from her testimony. And, you know, I'd like to move on just briefly to a couple of the other issues. The judge's bias. He is a good judge, and I don't dispute that. But in this particular case, the government in this brief suggested that, he ruled in the defendant's favor a few times. If you look at the record carefully, and I looked at the footnote that the state in the brief attached, where he ruled in the defendant's favor. And when he rules in the defendant's favor, he just says objection sustained or objection overruled or whatever. None of the negative or the kinds of comments that would be leading or the kinds of advocacy that a jury would draw negative inferences from. There's a qualitative difference. And I point that out to the court to look at those 8 or so citations to the record that the prosecutor cited in that brief because it shows the qualitative difference. The issue regarding the comment on a privilege, I think I've discussed that, and it's an issue of whether or not the defendant was prejudiced. I think that this was a real comment on a privilege. The defendant did not leave him bring this up deliberately so he could be, he didn't leave himself open to this. This wasn't invited error. I mean, he had a right to bring up there was no DNA evidence. They did not have the right to bring this comment on his fundamental Fifth Amendment right before the jury to make him look bad. And that's basically my argument to the court. I thank you for your time.
Well, thank you both. I know you both put a lot of work into these briefs, and we appreciate the citations to the record. That was very helpful to us in analyzing it, and we will take this matter under submission, and we'll be in recess.